few years ago, I was doing premarital counseling with this couple, and we were talking about commitment. And this morning, we're going to be talking about how committed we are in our relationship with God. And as this new year starts, and as all the kind of twists and turns our journey may take this year, but we were sitting in this room, and these were really good. These are really good students. When you do premarital counseling, there are generally two types of people that do premarital counseling. They're the people that are really excited about premarital counseling. Are you guys warm? Okay. Well, that was a stupid question. I should never have asked that question. You know, you'd think I'd been a minister long enough to know better than to ask that question. It's just hot up here, so I just that's why I ask, because it's hot up here. But I'll be fine. If I sweat off a couple pounds, that's okay. But there's two types of people in premarital counseling. There's the type of people who are only doing it because you require it to do the wedding. There's those people. And then there's people that are really excited about it. And there's usually not a whole lot of in-between space. Usually you really, really want to do it, or you really, really don't want to do it, but you don't have a choice. This couple really was into it, and they brought notebooks, which kind of terrifies me, because somewhere in a house right now, there's a couple who are looking back at words of wisdom from me to stay married. Take that for what it's worth. But they brought notebooks, and so we're sitting there one night, and I said, I want you to think about the reasons that the two of you would split apart, that you would get divorced. Now, what you hope happens in that moment is that they look at you and go, no, can't really think. She went to writing. And it wasn't like one word. She was like numbering them. One, two, three. I mean, and as she began to number them, he was like, and they compiled a list. I mean, she had like, it was almost like a Dave Letterman top 10 list. I mean, she had I just kind of sat there and I just kind of let it go, because I was intrigued to see what was on the list. And he was too. So when they finished writing, and they probably spent about 10 minutes writing. And I said, you guys do understand what commitment is, right? And she said, yeah, I commit to him as long as he doesn't irritate me. And I have, we haven't even gotten to the good part yet. She said, and I've compiled a list of things he should avoid to not irritate me. Now, a couple of these are the ones that you would, you would understand. Yeah. He can never strike me. Okay, that's reasonable. Domestic abuse, right out. Gotcha. No cheating. Okay, gotcha. Keep your job. I said, well, what if he's injured? She goes, that's number five. Stay healthy. Now, at this point, I start to think that I am somehow part of some inside joke that they have planned together, until I look at him. And this is the look on his face. And I thought, this marriage will last 35 minutes. He's going to irritate her at the reception, and this thing will be annulled before they get in the car. So we had a long conversation about the vows. And how many of you remember the vows? Let's see. For better or for worse, richer for poor. She had forgotten that one. Sickness and health. No, that got that. So long as you both shall live. Now, I have long believed that every couple that gets married means those things in the moment that they say them. Just like most people, I think, that accept Christ expect to be Christians their entire life when they do it. But then again, how many things have you committed to? The minute you committed to it, you were serious about it forever. None of you. Okay, well, that kind of changes the direction of the sermon a little bit, maybe. We have a mentality that is developed, and I don't want to say in our country because I don't think it's a nationality issue. I just think it's a societal issue. It's a humanity issue. That our concept of commitment is skewed somewhat, that we have become a people that we will stick with something as long as it's convenient or as long as it's beneficial or as long as we like it, but that when things get problematic or difficult, then that commitment begins to waver a little bit, and we'll make declarations like, I'm going to do this, I'm committed to this, and then 10 minutes later, like, oh, well, maybe not. So this morning we're going to look at a text in the Old Testament, which I think is a really good example setter for the type of commitment and the type of relational commitment we're supposed to have with Christ, and maybe one that we can try to emulate in the year 2020 as we move forward. We're going to be looking at a passage from the book of Ruth. Now, I'm going to do a little bit of a backstory here because I don't want to read the whole chapter, but there's some backstory here. There is a woman who lives in Jerusalem. Her name is Naomi. And she and her husband are living in Jerusalem when a severe famine strikes the land of Judah. And when that famine strikes, much like people in Israel had in the past when famines hit, a lot of people packed up and moved away while the famine was severe in Judah. In fact, we know that there are other cases all the way back to Abraham. When Abraham first got to the promised land, there was a famine, and he packed up and went to Egypt. So we know that Joseph's brothers, remember when he got sold into slavery, there was a famine, and people had to go to Egypt to buy food. So this, in that part of the world, famines were not uncommon. And so a famine struck Judah, and Naomi and her husband packed up and moved to the land of Moab. And so they settled in Moab among the pagans. And so they're living in Moab where there's food. And in the time that they were there, Naomi's two sons both married local girls. And so they're all living there in Moab. And then as fate would have it, Naomi's husband dies. And then about a decade later, both of her sons die. Now, the scripture doesn't tell us what happened to them. It just says that now here is Naomi, and she's living in Moab with her two Moabite daughter-in-laws, and there's no men. She has no way to kind of provide. And so she finds out that the famine has ended in Judah, and she decides it's time to go home. So as she's getting ready to leave, she says to these girls, Orpah, now that's not Oprah. If you're reading the story real fast, you're like, Oprah was in the Bible. I had no idea, but it's not Oprah, it's Orpah. Orpah and Ruth are the two daughters, and so she tells them, I'm getting ready to go home, and you girls need to stay here. You need to go back to your family's home. You need to go back. She says, look, I realize you may want to stay with me, but I don't have any more sons. There's nobody for you to marry. If you want to be married, if you want a husband and have a family, you need to go home. Go back to your mom's house and start over again, but I can't provide anything for you. There's no reason to stay with me. And some of you right now are picturing, my mother-in-law, would I stay with my mother-in-law but didn't have a reason to? And I could tell by some of your faces that there's a story there, but not for today. Deborah almost got up and moved to the other side of Don as Ethel kind of clung to her. She would stay. Hey, if that's your story, Ethel, stick with it. Deborah, don't tell her any different. Just let her believe that. Let her believe it, Deborah. Let her believe it. All right. So we're going to pick up in Ruth chapter 1, verse 14. So at that time, it says, they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And so at this time, Orpah takes Ruth's advice. She kisses her goodbye, and she gets up, and she goes home. But it says, Ruth clung to her. And then in verse 15, it said, then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Okay, so it's important here to note the cultural thing that Naomi, even though she's living in Moab, she is a Jewish woman. She worships her God. And she tells Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone home to her people, back to worship the gods that she was raised on, back to her culture, back to everything she's familiar with. You should probably do the same thing. So it says, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. You need to go back. But in verse 16, we get Ruth's response, and this is really the crux of what I want to talk about this morning. I want you to listen to some of the things she says to her mother-in-law in this statement. In verse 16, it says, but Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. So when it's just look at that first section here. How many of you have ever in a relationship been with somebody who was facing having to relocate? Any of you? I have a friend who not long ago married a guy in the military. And I said to her, I said, now, when you marry this guy, you realize that you may have to travel. And she said, oh yeah, I like travel. I said, yes, don't we all? I said, you do realize that you don't get to pick where you travel to. I said, and that's always an important part of the equation. There is a thing that she says here, which is fascinating to me, and especially as we equate this to our relationship with God. He says, don't urge me to go, but I want you to listen to this. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I'm going to lodge. Now, that is a pretty impressive statement, considering that Ruth doesn't know anything about where Naomi's going. How many of you have ever gone someplace and you got where you were going and you thought, wow, this is a dump? You got somewhere and you're like, I remember in college, one of my favorite things from college is like when spring break or like when some of the breaks would come up, we'd all decide who was going to go home with who. And so over my time at Johnson in those 4 years, I got to go to some really cool places. I went to some places that were really not that cool. When people describe their home, they usually make it sound like a really cool place to go. Now, on the odd chance that any of my friends from Johnson will ever get on Facebook and listen to the sermon, I'm not naming any of the places I went that were not cool. But let me just say there were a couple places that I got to and I thought, wow. My roommate for 2 years, Gene, 1 year came home with me to Crestwell. Now, to explain this, Gene was from Butler, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Pittsburgh. And in Butler, every house is identical. Just squared off. Just blocks and blocks and blocks of the exact same house. And I remember when we got into the neighborhood, I said, how do you find your house? He said, I count the roads. Five roads down, three roads over. I was like, that's how you find your house. I said, what if you miss one? He goes, I knock on the wrong door. He said, usually you can tell when you put your key in it, it doesn't fit. Okay. And I'm not kidding. I mean, you get out and you're like, you look around and like, they all look the same. Every one of them look the same. Kressel is not like that. He got to Kressel. I tried to describe the country to him, being from Butler, Pennsylvania. I tried to describe the country to him. But you know, it's hard to describe the country to somebody who's not from the country. We got there, and we pulled up into the yard, and he... I said, what are you looking for? He said, the outhouse. And I said, I could show you where some are still at. A couple of them still functional, best I remember. He's like, no, that was a joke. He got outside and he saw live cows and some chickens. And we got really lucky that day. The dude on Newland Road's llama was out. So he got to see a llama. And he was mystified at how anybody could live in that kind of place. And I told him that's why I had gone to Knoxville. I explained it to him. So not knowing anything about where she's going to go or what she's going to experience, Ruth says to her mother-in-law, don't tell me to turn back. Wherever you go, I'm going to go, and wherever you stay, wherever you lodge, I'm going to lodge. So I want you to take a moment right now and ask yourself a question about your relationship with Christ for this coming year. And that is, would you be willing right now to close your eyes and say to God, I will follow you this year, and I will go wherever you go, and I'll stay wherever you stay. Now, some of you are thinking, well, of course I would say that. But it's really not a question of whether or not you'd say it. It's really more a question of, do you mean it? Now, that's an easy thing to say if you're sitting there this morning thinking, yeah, but in my life situation, he ain't going to take me nowhere. I'm here. He's not taking. What if God this year decided to move you to a different place? And I don't necessarily mean a physical address. Just a different place spiritually, or emotionally, or relationally, whatever. But something happened this year where God said, this is where you've been for a long time, but I want to move you. I want you to come with me. We're going to go over here. Now, one of the things that a lot of church people say, and I've heard it said in this very room, I've heard it said to me as kind of a joke, I've heard it said to me with a stern look of disapproval. Stuart, I don't like change. I do not like change. And so for those of you who are sitting there right now thinking, I will love God as long as he leaves me alone. As long as he doesn't try to change the status quo, as long as my circumstance on December 31st of 2020 is relatively unchanged from January 5th, 2020, as long as he doesn't try to do anything crazy with me this year, I will follow him anywhere that doesn't take me anywhere. I will follow him to church on Sunday occasionally. I will follow him. Maybe I'll follow him to the hospital to visit somebody. Maybe I'll follow him, you know, I'll go do some Christmas caroling. Yeah, I've got some things. I'll follow him to Hope Lodge maybe every once in a while. As long as he doesn't try to do anything crazy with me. And I just want to tell you right now, God is not interested in that deal if that's the deal you're willing to make. Ruth looks at her mother-in-law and says, I'll go where you go. And I don't know anything about the place you're going to take me. I don't know any of the people that live there. I don't know the customs. I don't know the God. I don't know any of that stuff. But I am committed to you. And so I will go wherever you take me. I'll go where you go, and I'll stay where you stay, and I'm not worried about where it is, because I care enough about you that I'm going to follow you wherever you want to take me. Now, there is something, so some of you are probably sitting here and you're thinking, there's something disconcerting about that kind of commitment, right? What is so disconcerting about that kind of commitment? What's that? The unknown. The unknown. Well, now, Lord, how many of you don't like surprises? How many don't like surprises? I have a feeling that if I came home, I don't know. I'm trying to. Oh, there she is. If I came and told my wife, said, "Hey, guess what? We're going somewhere. Where are we going? I'm not telling." My wife would get exceptionally nervous. Is that true, baby? Yep. Because now there's, I realize that when I say this to you, some of you are going to look at her and go, "Huh? She married me, but she don't like surprises." I know what you're thinking. That doesn't make any sense at all. Stuart is a walking surprise. You never know what he's going to do or what he's going to say. And that is correct. I tried to hide that from her until we got married and she was trapped. Some of us are planners. We like to know every detail. We like to know every fabric. Last week in the sermon, I referenced that God came to Abram and said, "I want you to get up and you're going to go to a land I'm going to show you." I was reading that story this week. Let me tell you something really funny about that story. When Abram got to where God was taking him, you know what God said to him? Any of you know? He got there and he said, "This land, I'm going to give it to your descendants." Guess who's not included in descendants? Abraham. "I'm going to give this land to your descendants." Let's keep walking. And so Abraham keeps walking. And then he gets to a place and God goes, "How do you like this place?" And he goes, "It's all right." And then a famine strikes the land and Abram has to flee to Egypt. Now, if you were Abram, would you be second guessing your decision to follow God to a place he would show you? If the first thing he showed you when you got there was a famine? There is something disconcerting about looking at God and saying, "Look, I trust you. I have faith in you. But I'm not willing to tell you that I'll go where you want to take me and I'll stay where you want me to stay because I don't trust you that much." And that's the situation. That's the situation we find ourselves in sometimes in our relationship with God. We love him. We trust him. We acknowledge we trust him. We acknowledge we have faith in him. But when it gets right down to it, "Lord, I'm going to take my hands off. I'm going to let you go. You take me where you want to take me this year. And if you want to take me someplace other than where I'm at, then I'll go. And if you pick a place you want me to be, that's where I'll be. And you know, no questions asked." Then she says this, "Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." She said, "Your people will be my people." Now, she said that not knowing what? Any of her people. I want you to take a second, and I want you to just look around this room. Just take a second, look around. Just take a peek. Some of you aren't looking. That's okay. Just disobedient stiff-necked people. You look around this room. You know what you see when you look around this room? You see some messed up people.
Wait a minute, I represent that remark.
Why? Huh? I know, that's why I got my hand up here, Don. Now, why do I say that there's messed up people in this room? Because we're people by definition, we're messed up. We're flawed people. Did you know that if you went to any church in Pitt County today, regardless of the denomination or the size of the church, regardless of what they practice or what they believe, regardless of what style of worship they have or how long the guy preaches, any church you walk into this morning, if you look around, you know what you're going to see? Messed up people. Because people are by definition messed up. And if we weren't messed up, guess where we wouldn't need to be today? We wouldn't need to be here. If we weren't messed up, we wouldn't need God. We wouldn't need forgiveness. We wouldn't need salvation. We wouldn't need grace if we weren't messed up. So here's the question. Are you willing to tell Christ this year, your people are my people? When we think about church, we had a conversation about this in our seniors' Bible study Thursday morning. We have become a people who equate church with the building or maybe even the service. But the church is not the building or the service. It's a church building and it's a church service. But what is the church? It's you guys. It's us. We are the church. It's not the building and it's not the service. It's not the stuff. It's the people. The people are the church. And one of the things that we see an increasing number of people saying in our culture is, oh, I want to have a relationship with God, but I don't want anything to do with the church. Okay, so let me just say, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And for those of you going, why? I think it does. Then you're wrong. And the reason I know you're wrong is because in the New Testament, Christ instituted the church. And he did it for a reason. And it has a purpose. And it has a function. And when Ruth looks at Naomi and she goes, not only am I willing to go where you go. Now, I think the second part is important. And so I want you to follow me here. How many of you have ever seen someone in a place who obviously didn't want to be there? And you know how they let everybody know they don't want to be there? They don't socialize or talk to anybody. They just kind of like, and I want to be clear, I'm not talking about introverts because I know the difference, okay? I've got family members who are introverts. There's a difference in not necessarily wanting to communicate with a bunch of people and not wanting to be with a bunch of people. There's a difference. Ruth tells her mother-in-law, look, I'll go wherever you go, and when I get there, I'm going to make your people my people. I'm going to fit in. I'm going to become part of the community. I'm going to be involved and engaged in relationships with your people. And why am I going to do that? Because they're your people. And because of my relationship with you, because I love you so much, I'm going to accept, Ruth, that your people, the Jews, they're going to be my people. And what we see in increasing numbers in the church today is people who tell God, I will go with you, I'll go to church, but your people are not my people. I'm going to go to the place, but I don't really want to be around. I don't want to interact. I don't want to have fellowship. I don't want to be connected. I'm going to go, but I want to be apart. Now, why do people say, I don't want to be a part of the people? Well, keep in mind, she's saying that your people are going to be my people before she knows the people. What happens if Ruth gets there and she doesn't like the people? Well, they're my people now. We all have that family member, right? The one that we don't talk about, you know, to other people. We all have that friend. When I was in high school, I know we all had that friend that it was like, this was my friend, but if my other friends were around, I tried to kind of just, because I didn't want you didn't want everybody to know that you were friends with that person. Any of you have that friend? Well, some of you are going, I was that friend. It's like, I don't want everybody to know. Ryan, are you that friend?
No, I'm not that friend.
There's an entire row right there that seems to think you are. I'm just, yeah, there's, come on, Dylan. Dylan just went, oh, it's not. At least it's not me. Yeah. We've all know that circumstance. One of the things, and I say this with all seriousness and all candor. One of the things that kills a church is a body of people that are not each other's people. I go there, but I'm not one of them. Well, what does that even mean? I'm not connected. I don't really like them. I mean, I go because I have to go to church, but I don't really identify with them. I don't connect with them. I'm not engaged with them. I'm kind of separate. And that does not create an atmosphere of community, of support, of acceptance. Those things don't exist in that kind of circumstance. So Ruth says, look, when I go with you, I'm going to go. I'm not just going to go where you go, but your people are going to be my people. Your God's going to be my God. I am invested. I am all in this relationship. And so I'm gonna adapt to your people. All right, next verse. She says, where you die, I'm going to die. And there I'm going to be buried. Why does she say that? Can anybody just tell me, why do you think she says that? Where you die, I'm going to die. And that's where I'm going to be buried. Now, let's notice something. She's committed, but committed to what? Now, think about this, guys. If Ruth is the daughter-in-law, that means that Naomi is probably older than her, right? Let's just throw a number out. Let's say maybe Naomi's 25 years older, maybe 25, 30 years older. But listen to what she says. Where you die, what?
I will.
Which means that if Naomi dies and Ruth is still in her 30s or 40s, what is she committing to? I'm going to stay there. I'm not going to stay there until you die and then pick up and move. Because if I do that, your people haven't become my people. This isn't until death do us part. This is until I die. I'm not going and sticking around until you die and then I can leave. She says, wherever you die, that's where I'm going to die. And that's where I'm going to be buried. That's how committed I am to this relationship. I'm not going until you die and then I feel like, oh, well, now she's dead so I don't owe her anything. I'm so committed to this. I'm so committed to the concept of going to where you go and your people being my people, that when you die, I'm going to stay. I'm going to stay until I die. And there's no time frame. If you die next year and I live for 50 more years, that's where I'm going to be. It is a statement of commitment to Naomi that Ruth makes it. I am going to die in your home. I'm not just in this until you die. This is a permanent change for me, and that's how much I honor and respect you, that this is permanent. When we enter into covenants, a lot of times we enter into relationships and we enter into to contracts. We always, in most contracts, there are out clauses. I will stay with you as long as this happens, or as long as you provide this, or as long as that happens. And if you notice that in a marriage covenant, in the vows, there's no out contract. You notice that nowhere in the marriage vows it say, I will keep thee only unto you as long as you don't do this. It doesn't say that in the marriage vows. There's a reason that those terms don't exist in the marriage vows. There's a reason that Ruth makes this declaration to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And it's the type of relationship that God wants from us. It is a statement of commitment. I am going to be with you until the end, until my end. I am in this for the long haul. Whatever happens, this is my choice. This is my commitment. I sit here and I think about what it must be like to be a teenager. They're all sitting here in the front two rows. And I remember, I have vague recollections of being a teenager. I remember being a teenager thinking that 35 was just about a step away from death. You know, when you're a teenager, you're like, whoa, man, look at that. That's an old person right there. How old is that person? They got to be close to 40. I remember thinking that was ancient. Now I'm 52 going, I knew nothing. But man, I thought that was really old. And conceptualizing 20, 30, 40, 50 years at that age was really, really difficult. This level of commitment that God is asking for from us, and we're just, you know, we're talking about 2020, but it obviously should extend far beyond that. But when we think about our relationship with God and how committed to him we are, we start saying, you know, I'm committed to God until or unless, and then you fill in the blank. How would you fill that blank in? I'm committed to God until he doesn't give me something I ask for. I'm committed to God until things don't go my way. I'm committed to God as long as I'm healthy, or as long as I've got a good job, or as long as this happens, or as long as that happens, or as long as nobody at the church makes me mad, or nobody looks at me funny, or nobody sits in my seat. But I'm committed until or as long as this. And Ruth, in this statement, sets the parameters for what our commitment level to God should be. This is it. Where you die, I'm going to die. That's where I'll be buried. And then she says this, thus may the Lord do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. You know what she's telling her? When you're old and your health is bad, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to be there. And if we go to Jerusalem and things don't go well and you have to pack up and move somewhere else, I'm going to go with you. And no matter what happens in your life, I'm going to take care of you. Even if I find a husband and I have a family, I'm still going to take care of you. I'm going to be with you until the end. And I swear to that by saying, thus may the Lord do to me and worse if I do not fulfill my vow to you, Naomi, mother-in-law. I will be with you until the end. And then it says in verse 18, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, that seems like an understatement. Says she didn't say anything else. Okay, come with me. Now, the reality is that in our relationship with God, there are a lot of unknown variables. Okay? There are a lot of unknown variables. And we talked about this, we touched on this a little bit last Sunday. We don't know where God's going to take us this year. We don't know what God's got in store for each of us individually or collectively. We don't know. God may take some of you in some interesting situations. You know what? It's possible that some of you who are sitting in here today will not be with us at the end of this year. It's a possibility. There's a possibility that sometime this year, circumstances may happen where some of you have to you have to go somewhere else. You move away or something. God may call some of you to some type of ministry. We were talking, we've got kids who are talking about going to Bible college, and I've talked with some of them. I said, you know, fun thing about college is you never know where you're going to end up. You know, you go into the ministry, you don't know where God's going to take you. That's one of the fun things about taking your hands off the wheel and telling God to steer. I've heard Barb talk about how she never guessed she'd end up in North Carolina. Right next to Betty. But you know what? Here you are. Yeah. We don't know where God's going to take us this year. It would be great if I could say that at the end of this year, everybody would be exactly where they want to be. But you know what I've learned? That's not the way life happens. That's not exactly the way things go. We don't always end up exactly where we want to be. We don't know where God's going to take us in this next year. But there is one thing that we can control, and that is our commitment to him regardless of where he takes us. And Ruth, I think Ruth does a beautiful job of describing the type of faith and trust in that relationship that we should have with God, the type that she had with her mother-in-law. Where you go, I'm going to go. Where you stay, that's where I'm going to stay. Your people are good enough to be my people. So they're going to be my people. And I'm going to be with you till the end. If we can bow our heads today and make that kind of commitment to God, that's a good start to our year. Especially if we mean it. Lord, I don't know where you're going to take me this year. I don't know who your people are. I don't know what kind of people you're going to introduce me to. I don't know where you're going to move me, where you're going to park me. I don't know. But wherever it is, I'm going to go with you. I'm along for the ride, and I'm going to accept it. I'm going to make the best of it. And I'm going to be faithful to the commitment. If we can all do that this morning, it's going to be a good year. It's going to be a good year. Why do I say it's going to be a good year? Because we're going to be committed to a relationship with God in this year, and that's always a good way to start. We're going to stand and sing our hymn of invitation this morning. I want to challenge you to think about Ruth's commitment to her mother-in-law and how we can apply that to our relationship and commitment to God this morning as we sing our hymn of invitation together.